Oops. There we go. With that introduction, I want to talk to you about a little bit about what some of us hope will be happening after next Tuesday. One way or the other, there is going to be a new administration. And we have been and we have been working with a very large, I guess, I follow too many directions. See, I actually put this slide in. I have no financial relations to disclose, other than to say that the work we did on this blueprint was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is an important disclosure. What we've been trying to do at Trust for America's Health, for those of you who don't know us, we are an advocacy organization. I like to say we're an evidence-based advocacy organization, so we try to take on issues that exemplify the importance of having a strong public health system in this country, to be emphasizing prevention, and in fact, we try to stay away from the healthcare side of the health equation. But we try to do evidence-based advocacy in the sense that we don't take on issues until we've actually documented what is going on and how we might best solve them. In preparation for the election and for a new administration, we undertook what we're calling the Healthier America Project, not to be confused with the Healthiest Nation Project, not to be confused with everything else that says healthy in America in it. And with 140 organizations, we articulated during the campaign a vision for a healthier America. That really emphasized prevention, emphasized preparedness, emphasized the need for the government to do all it can to help people be as healthy and as safe as possible. All these documents are, I will tell you in a moment, where you can find them. But with 140 organizations signed on, we were able to reach far beyond the traditional public health community. And I'm pleased to say that in both the Democratic and Republican platforms, we could find elements of this vision articulated. How that gets translated into policy is another story, and that's ultimately what this blueprint that we have just released last week is all about. It's a comprehensive set of recommendations for both, and we're thinking about both Congress and the administration. We have no certainty about how the election is going to turn out, and in fact, not everything can be done administratively. There's a lot of work that Congress is also going to need to do. We developed this blueprint by talking and talking and talking. Larry helped host one of the meetings that dealt with social determinants and disparities. But we had many meetings and many consultations with literally hundreds of people in trying to address some of the key public health policy issues, as well as look in a very practical way at what's happening in the individual agencies so we can give a guide to those who are coming into office from a perspective that, quite frankly, many new policymakers don't always have. And we begin with the notion that we need to have a government-wide health perspective, a prevention perspective that begins at the White House. In our perfect world, in the first few weeks or month or so that the new president is in office, there will be an executive order in which prevention and health are identified as driving the core of what the new administration will be doing in domestic policy, that we're talking about health and not just health care expertise on the White House staff. I had the privilege of being on the Domestic Policy Council staff in a previous administration, but there was no one who did public health. There were lots of people who did health care. There were people who did specific diseases. I worked on HIV. There was no one who worked on health or public health per se. That has to change. There needs to be a national prevention strategy that looks across the government at health issues, that teaches every agency of the government that they indeed have a role to play in public health, in keeping the country healthy, in keeping people healthy, along the lines that you heard from the previous speakers. And in fact, with the notion of health in every policy, we're actually proposing that there be a health office in every agency of the government, and that at some stage of the policy development process, there has to be a health review for those policies. So that some of those agencies, it may be a little bit obvious. Talk about transportation and health. Other agencies, it may be less obvious, but it can be just as important, especially when we're thinking about social and economic policy. We also believe that we need to make sure that from henceforth, science does actually drive health policy, and that there be a buffer placed between the politics and the science. One option that we've put forward is the creation of a national public health board that could set broad national priorities and would be, in a sense, an accountability board that would see how the government is doing and how the multiple sectors of society are doing. This is not just a government-driven enterprise, but if we're going to have a national prevention strategy, we need to start with the government and then see how the government engages everyone, state, local, federal government, private sector, schools, communities, everyone. But we also need independent oversight of that process. Both to protect the science, but also to make sure that there is some honest assessment as to the progress we're making and how we may need to re-engineer our recommendations. You'll see re-empowering the Surgeon General twice. That's part of keeping science uppermost in our minds. It also is part of making sure that the Department of Health and Human Services is prevention-oriented. Now I'm beginning to sound very Washington-centric, I suppose, I'm going to start playing with organization charts, but sometimes organization charts do matter. I often say that when people reorganize an agency, they're trying to avoid dealing with the personnel problem most of the time. They're avoiding the personnel problem. But this is a case where actually we've created a problem because we disempowered, in the last Democratic administration, disempowered the Assistant Secretary for Health. So the individual public health service agencies do not report to someone who has a broad public health perspective. And so in talking with lots of folks, this is actually the broadest consensus, is the belief that the Assistant Secretary should be re-empowered, restore line authority to the public health service agencies, and elevated to the level of an undersecretary for health. The next part's a little bit more controversial. To whom? The public health service agencies would report, the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response would report, so that state and local governments in particular are not getting mixed messages about what's going on, and we would argue the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services should also report to someone whose primary mission is public health. We have to, in the absence of health reform, we have to think of these public programs as not just check writers and not just another version of an insurance system, but as programs that play a critical role in public health and improving health. Again, reinvigorating the Surgeon General will play a role in that, and we need to rebuild the workforce. And Carmen spoke, I think, eloquently about the breadth of what we define as workforce and how we think differently about the workforce. And the blueprint has a series of recommendations, both in terms of who we are recruiting, how we are training people, and how we pay them, so that it becomes a validated and valuable career. We also need to make sure that we have reliable funding streams. Larry spoke about our report, Prevention for a Healthier America, that showed that we actually can get a return on investment. That shouldn't be the only basis deciding to invest in prevention, but it makes the argument a lot easier and a lot more compelling. But what's also important is that public health have reliable funding streams, and we've been subject to the vicissitudes of the appropriations process and the reliability of the economy in a way that other programs have not. And one option that we've put on the table and are supportive of is the notion of a wellness trust. This is something that came out of the Center for American Progress and the Brookings Institute Hamilton Project. It's actually been introduced in legislative form by Senator Clinton a few weeks ago. And it essentially would create single mayor for prevention activities. The wellness trust would essentially have as an entitlement stream, the money that would otherwise be spent by public insurance programs on prevention, and this is clinical prevention and community prevention, and it would also tap private insurance dollars. That would then be spent in creating, in either reimbursing providers for clinical prevention or in reimbursing state and local health departments for prevention services they are providing or community organizations. That wellness trust would have the ability to determine what are the most effective mechanisms around prevention, what our priorities should be, and would be, again, independent somewhat of the politics. There's a lot. This is, you know, not an easy concept. Where this will emerge in the health reform discussions, I don't know. But what it's important about it is that it in two ways. One is it sets prevention as a priority, as an equal player in the health reform debate. And number two, it is putting community prevention and clinical prevention at the same level. We also did some work with the New York Academy of Medicine to try to identify, convening an expert panel to identify how much more money do we actually need in the public health system. You know, what I talked about in terms of this is clinical and community prevention, there's a lot more to public health than that. So how do we make sure it is adequately funded? Long story short, we need an extra $20 billion, was the consensus, $12 billion of it being a federal responsibility. Sounds like a lot of money. It would be a lot of money to absorb over a relatively short period of time, but we think it can be done over 4 to 5 years, in other words, in a first administration. And just to be clear about how much ground we have to catch up, we also have in this document a budget analysis. And it turns out that fiscal 2005 was sort of the peak for most public health programs. And just to restore those programs to their fiscal 2005 level plus inflation would take $2 billion. A billion of that is at the CDC alone. So that's an incredible amount of money. When we're asking for more money, we have to be more accountable. And we have a series of proposals here that would, first of all, give states and localities a whole lot more flexibility in how they design their programs and how they spend their programs in exchange for being accountable for health outcomes. So we're not counting how many condoms we've distributed, we're not counting how many brochures we've printed, but have we improved the health of a community? And in exchange for that, the federal government should be giving folks more money and more flexibility in how they spend it. Finally, we do have a series of principles related to public health and health reform. We are actually agnostic on the financing method. Our primary goal here is to make sure that as this conversation moves forward on health reform, and it is moving forward, where it will end up, we don't know, but that the public health concept and that the prevention concept be central players of that discussion. We argue that whatever system we end up with, it has to be universal because it is a critical component. But we also need to make sure that we have good prevention, that we have reliable funding for public health. We're doing something not just about the medical workforce, but also about the public health workforce. And that when we talk about quality assurance and quality improvement, we're talking about prevention, not just about health care. And that when we reform the system, we think about how we finance and assure that we have a system that is prepared for public health emergencies as well. You can find the blueprint at our website, which is healthyamericans.org. I have a couple of Xerox copies of it. The printed versions will be out shortly. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Thanks. Any questions from the audience? And I'll call on you, but if you get up to speak, could you say your name and where you're from so we can kind of tell us?
So one is have you considered the possibility of
it's just Alice Rarick from Alaska.
Document how we're doing. We need denominators.
Okay. Anybody want to respond?
Oh, I'm the data maven.
Yeah.
You couldn't have said it better. There's no question about that. The answer was yes.
Yes. That. Repeat the question. This is about really getting the data and getting the data for the denominators, because the next census is going to be a shorter form. We're not going to have all the information that we need for a lot of what I think Carmen spoke about as far as needing the data and the kinds of data that we're going to need to have a sense of whether we're making any changes or any improvements. So it's so one of the suggestions is that people really talk to their legislators, push to have complete data, the complete demographics. And then the other part of the question was, does APHA have any questions for new appointees? And there's a lot of work going into that. So, yes. Okay, let me hear. And the question was about not mentioning low birth weight and the cost of obesity as sort of things that could be prevented.
We actually did a paper for the Annie Casey Foundation, which you can find at our website, called Healthy Moms, Healthy Babies. And this is a case where universal coverage really is, I think, a critical piece of the equation. Because our focus, you know, one of the we were asked to do, in a sense, do this because, you know, why is it that infant mortality rates have sort of flattened and we haven't continued to make progress? And I think where the science is now is that we need to be thinking about preconception care, which, and since half of all pregnancies are unplanned, it really means everyone needs to be in health, certainly every woman needs to be in healthcare. I don't know, we'll have to find another justification for men. and that is going to be, so reconceptualizing, so to speak, how we're thinking about the infant mortality problem to one of keeping the mother healthier, keeping women healthier, is a critical part of, I think, the universal coverage debate.
And I would just like to add to it, we've done a lot of work in our organization on strategies related to nutrition and activity, related to disease, related to injury, related to lots of other things. There was no opportunity to cover that in detail. I mean, breastfeeding is another comment that would make in relation to what you're saying, and getting rid of the marketing of infant formula and, you know, giving out free infant formula in hospitals. But we just didn't go there, but I'm really glad that you did, because I think it's one important piece.
Okay. Let's see. Person, standing there. Who's next?
Data to really back that up. It's incredible to me the amount of money that
Let me move over to this side of the room here. Okay, so the question is, who are going to be the key policymakers in the next administration, and who do we need to be talking to, you know, to get these ideas to them so that they can use them in formulating the policy? You want to start?
Sarah Silverman?
You guys?
Well, I mean, we'll know soon enough. At 4:30, there's a town hall meeting where the presidential candidates are going to be represented,
at least two of them, yes. Right.
we have two. Starting place. It's going to be, there'll be a lot of dust settling in the first few days after the election to know exactly who's going to be addressing these issues. I mean, I can talk to you afterwards and give you sort of my brain dump. But I wouldn't want something on tape that turned out to be
Okay, I'm going to do another question from this side back. Lois? There.
On that in the blueprint, but I will also be honest with you that how you translate that from sort of national objectives to then measuring the progress in programs and in grants is not fully resolved. How's that word?
Okay, let me go back to, okay, I'll wait it out. Okay, she wants to know how prevention could be incorporated into a national stimulus plan.
Well, to begin with, I'll just throw out the number of $15 billion, which is 10% of $150 billion. An example, and it's a key example right now, and it's probably best to just give a couple of examples. A key example right now is that there's going to be a transportation bill next year in Congress.
Right.
This is perhaps it's the sixth largest federal expenditure, and it's the largest expenditure where money comes down to states and localities of all federal expenditures. People talk about building roads. We could just as easily say, where does transportation fit into prevention? What are we going to do to build bike paths? What are we going to do to increase public transportation? What are we going to do to have a real transit system in this country that is not polluting global warming? I think we could go through every sector, and this relates also to the reporting issue and the evaluation issue that was just mentioned. We could go through every sector and identify the health lens and the prevention lens and what could be done differently. We need jobs for young people. The violence rates in our country and particularly in our larger cities are obscene. We need a new urban agenda. We need to employ young people in jobs that are engaging them, that are green jobs, that are jobs that will lead to a new economy. Those are just a couple of examples. I'd love to be very specific, and part of our goal in a sign-on letter, and please give me your card, and I'll share what we've written so far. Part of our goal in a sign-on letter is to build a shared campaign that lays out what the most important specifics will be, and to do that within the next few weeks.
Okay. The lady right behind her, because you've had your hand up for a while.
leveling in the sense of, you know, parity, not necessarily dollar for dollar, but certainly in a greater investment. The report that Larry referenced that we did together proposed a $3 billion increase. In other words, $10 per capita in spending. We could see that return on investment of almost $16 billion. So that's the kind of level of investment that we're talking about. And it's talking about, you know, really investing in norms changing in the community, doing what each community determines is needed, whether it's more sidewalks, whether it's keeping playgrounds open, whether it's having safe routes to school, whether it's opening a supermarket. Actually, it's a combination of all of those things together that as a package would create a community prevention initiative. It has to be determined on a community-by-community basis, which is why we need to be more creative in how we get those dollars out to folks. But that's the kind of investment that certainly, you know, when you're thinking stimulus, for example, you know, community development is certainly going to be an issue. You know, when, you know, Carmen's slide about, you know, social policy, economic policy, all those other things, those, you know, how we start redeveloping communities. If we're going to start reinvesting in communities that have seen lots of foreclosures, what are we going to do as we reinvest in those communities? And what kind of health lens are we going to take on those? So it, you know, it doesn't even have to have technically the word health in it in order to be able to put that lens on it.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And one of my goals in making this presentation was to kind of, for us all to start enhancing our language, because we need to play a different role as health people, which is more of a facilitative and partnership and leadership role rather than a do-it-ourselves clinical role.
Right.
It's a new way of thinking, a new paradigm.
Okay. The gentleman back here.
Bernie Vermont, Fort Collins, Colorado, family doc. You know, I think that one of the things I'm hearing is that all the things that we're talking about prevention are incredibly important, but they're going to take money. And where is that money going to come from? And my answer would go along with the first presenter, is that the only way we're going to find money is in health systems. 17% of our GDP on health care, and we know that we need to start well before health care and health prevention, then we need money, and that money would say 8% of GDP to come from a single payer. So I do think that we need to not be agnostic about what we talk about, but rather say, where's the money going to come from? And we only have one proposal on the table that will save money.
Yeah, that's and I want to add that if you take a good hard look at the Senate Bill 840 in California and read it carefully, the section in it on prevention and health promotion is very solid. And when the bill was analyzed, the savings just from the prevention aspect of single payer in California was in the billions annually.
Yeah. Okay. I know there's a bunch of people waiting to, and there's some people who've had their hands up for a while, so Fern and then Rob. Okay.
I'm from ACHA Telecom Government, and Jeff, I want to thank you for the blueprints. I used it as a resource, and there's two bills in the Senate that have been introduced right now that need your senator's co-sponsorship. One is S3570, it's a public coordinating council that has the Surgeon General lining everybody up together and communicating regardless of what department they're in, if they're doing health work. And S3571 is the Health Impact Assessment Act, which looks at a lot of things, but if we're spending federal dollars, we have to look at the impact of health on whatever the project is. So if we can get some of your senators to sign on, we can advance that dialogue.
Thank you. Okay. Rob? Yeah.
My name is Bob Dell. I'm a student at Yale University. I've been involved in the Student Assembly and a bunch of different other health advocacy stuff. My question for the panel and for all of us is, you know, what's the time frame for some of these plans? You know,
3 weeks from today, we need
something. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the stimulus package aside, certainly how quickly the train's going to leave the station around health reform, I think, is the $2 trillion question. And I think, I think no one fully understands the impact of the current economic situation on that. All that said, I do not see any reduced determination on the part of Senator Kennedy to have some sort of a legacy health reform bill. I do see a lack of activity on the House side to match that enthusiasm on the Senate side. But the efforts on the Senate side are really very, very different from what we saw in 1994 in terms of people working cooperatively across committees of jurisdiction and even across parties. But I think what a lot of people in this room are probably going to need to recognize is that when Senator Kennedy is trying to find consensus, it's probably not going to be single payer. And it's probably not going to be the ideal version. And the question is whether, the conclusions I think people are going to have to draw is whether it is sufficiently better than where we were. And I think part of what is going to drive moving something forward, even in a difficult economic time, is the number of people who are losing their health insurance because they're losing their jobs. And what do we do in the meantime to take care of them, because we know that Medicaid is inadequate. And we know, that the current safety net system isn't working.
Let me add one more comment. I think that another determinant will be whether the margin of a win by Obama is this much or this much, because it then dictates how far he may or may not want to go. So that's one factor. The second is that for those of us in California that are getting behind closed doors in the single-payer movement, we are not at all contemplating a single-payer bill at the federal level for a long time. And that's why I framed my talk the way I did as perhaps a gift to the nation.
Okay. You've had your hand up for a while.
Hi, my name is Anne Scott. I'm from the American Society for Public Administration. And I'm just curious, because I guess I would argue that a big portion of the health policy window is actually closed, because of the lovely economic situation we have. So given that, given any number of other factors that are currently at play in Washington, what do you consider a win for public health in the first 100 days of the next administration?
See, I'm not, well, I don't know what the win would be in the first 100 days. First, let me know who's in charge. Even if you get the outcome of the election, even with the outcome of the election, then I'll be able to tell her what we can do in 100 days. But I think we have to be able to argue that even in this economic climate, that there are profound health issues that we have to be addressing. And that as people lose their jobs, they become more vulnerable than they were before. And just as we talked about extending unemployment benefits, we need to expand the food stamp program. If we expand the food stamp program, then there are opportunities there to broaden some demonstrations around incentivizing healthier eating. As people are losing their jobs, they're losing access to workplace wellness programs. There's an opportunity then to look about replacing those. Prevention. We need to look at, part of public health is also preparedness. We need to look at what is happening with state budgets and how the states are being forced to decimate a lot of what is happening in public health, from preparedness to traditional prevention activities. And as the federal government steps in, for example, to help states with their Medicaid budgets, they also should be thinking about helping them with the public health budgets, because ultimately that saves Medicaid dollars. So there are many different ways that we can frame this. I'm one of those, I'm not truly a hired gun, but give me any set of facts and I'll be able to make my argument. My feeling is if we could get billions of dollars out of the Reagan administration in my early days of doing HIV work, we can get out of a Democratic administration and a Democratic Congress, or a Republican administration and a Democratic Congress, however that election turns out, we should be able to get some public health investments as well.
Okay.
I want to add one concept to that, and I call that concept cost-free prevention. And I think there are sources of money when there's no new money. And one of the sources of money, I mean, I gave an example recently, there's going to be transportation money. How much of that money will go for roadways? Most important, I think, in many ways in urban communities is the issue of violence prevention. We spend huge amounts on violence in this country. We just spend that money after the fact. There's lots of ways to do things before the fact that save money. There's also the notion of waivers and flexibility where money coming down. I know people in the state of California have told me if it wasn't for some of the mandates, they could be a lot more effective with the resources that they had. Those are all examples of cost-free prevention.
Okay. Time for one more question. You've had your hand up for a while, so.
D&E.
And some of that's going to involve, it's going to be discussion of health reform issues too, so there's going to be quite a bit of discussion there. So as many of you who can go there would be really great to have you there to continue some of the discussion that's going on here, I think. I think people will stick around a little bit if people have further questions, but I'd like to thank all of you and thank the panel.
Particularly.